From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
San Francisco, south of Market.
From Albany,
Hayes Valley.
Rockridge in Oakland.
I'm from the Civic Center. I live across the street.
Coming up, Californians prepare for a clean energy future.
So we're looking at a tidal wave of money to do projects in California on renewable energy.
What Prop 39 means for the Golden State. One thing it doesn't mean is less driving, which is something you probably should not do blindfolded.
After it was over, they asked the participants to mime a lane change with an imaginary steering wheel in their hands. And sure enough, they went right back to making the same mistake.
And we'll get a lesson in multitasking from a brain scientist.
The impact of having a cell phone conversation while driving is not very different depending whether you're hands-free or not.
Keep your hands on the wheel. Cross Currents is right around the corner. California is on the verge of becoming much more energy efficient. That's because voters passed Proposition 39 on Election Day. It will tax out-of-state businesses and earmark those new billions of dollars for clean energy programs. To learn more about how it will work, we called Paul Rogers. He's the environmental writer for the San Jose Mercury News and managing editor for KQED's science programs. I asked him to tell me how Prop 39 came about, how it's going to change the state, and how that money is going to be applied.
This was a measure by San Francisco financier Tom Steyer, which closed a loophole in the way that out-of-state corporations pay taxes in California, and it will now generate $1 billion a year in new revenue. And for the first 5 years going forward, half of that money, actually a little more than half, $550 million a year, has to go to fund renewable energy projects. So we're looking at a tidal wave of money, $2.75 billion over the next 5 years, in new funds that's going to come in to do projects in California on renewable energy. Most of that is going to be things like retrofitting schools, community colleges, universities, putting better insulation in, solar panels on the roof, new windows. And that kind of thing is going to generate jobs. That's why a lot of unions supported this measure. But it's also going to lower the electricity bills at lots of schools and universities, probably by up to a third, when this stuff is put in. And that money, they're going to in turn be able to spend back on education.
So is the reason why those kinds of measures that are going to end up saving money, that those weren't taken before, is because they have that initial outlay of money, but Prop 39 is going to supply that?
Yeah, and I think the thing about Prop 39 was that, it wasn't affecting California corporations. It wasn't taxing anybody in California. There was a deal that was done in 2009 by Republicans in the legislature that allowed out-of-state corporations that do business in California to have two different options on the way they calculated their taxes. And, you know, the old way had basically been, how much do you sell? Take a percentage of that and pay a tax. That's what in-state corporations do. This other way allowed them a complex formula where they could look at the number of employees they have and all sorts of other things, and it basically lowered their taxes. So it didn't really hurt anybody in California, didn't raise anybody who's in California their taxes. And at the same time, a lot of the big out-of-state corporations who look like they were going to fight this, big auto companies and some big food companies, they decided in October to basically not put up all the money and not fight it. They looked at the polls. It was up in the high 60s. So they basically took a pass and bailed out. And it ended up passing 60-40. So, you know, that it's a $2.75 billion in new money for renewable energy in California is a really big deal. And, you know, I think there's some question that some folks have about how well is that money going to be spent? Is the legislature going to fritter it away? How much oversight is the State Public Utilities Commission and the California Energy Commission going to have? Is it going to end up, you know, like stem cell money, where some people aren't entirely happy the way that was spent after we put a bunch of money into stem cell research?
Or is the state going to be funding a Solyndra?
Right. Or is the state going to be funding a Solyndra? Although, you know, that's sort of the worst example. But, you know, this kind of stuff is not going to be direct support of businesses like Solyndra was, or low income or low interest loans. This is going to be, a grant to a school in your neighborhood to take out the leaky 1970s windows, single-pane windows, and put in place double or triple pane windows that will dramatically reduce your electricity bills. One of the great unknown, public unknowns about climate change and about air pollution is that we need to build massive high-tech solar farms and wind farms and things like that. Those are important, but you get a lot more savings on burning of fossil fuels if you do the boring things. If you go into buildings and you fix the ductwork so that when you turn on the air conditioning, you're not air conditioning the attic. Or if you go into old skyscrapers and replace all the windows, you can dramatically reduce the amount of electricity buildings use. And you can get lots more gains in greenhouse gas emissions than building, you know, huge installations of solar and wind all across the country.
There are already a lot of different programs through the government, it seems, where, like PG&E, for example, where you can get some sort of grants as a homeowner if you do energy upgrades at your home. So how is this different from that?
Well, a lot of those kind of programs are based on bills that the legislature has passed in years past, where you added a dollar here or 50 cents here to your PG&E bill every month. And certainly those programs are very important. This is different, remember, because the money isn't coming from California citizens. It's coming from out-of-state corporations, and it's going to fund public buildings. And certainly, you know, the life of a public building can easily be 100 years. And when you think about how little we've reinvested on some public buildings, hospitals, schools, government offices, university buildings, if this money is spent properly, it really could make a significant difference in greenhouse gas emissions and air pollution in California.
Well, talking about Prop 39, then, it also makes me wonder, if these are going to be out-of-state businesses, is that going to become a hindrance for them doing their business in California if they're going to have this extra tax because they no longer can take advantage of a loophole?
Well, you know, it's a good question, and it's a point that opponents of Prop 39 raised. There are some chambers of commerce that opposed it. The Republican Party opposed it. But in the end, the big corporations themselves weren't concerned enough about it to fund an opposition campaign. They're basically going back to paying taxes the way that they were before the rule was changed 3 years ago. And when you look at the people who supported Prop 39, a lot of them are business people. I mean, you know, former Secretary of State Schultz, a Republican, and Tom Steyer is a business guy, a billionaire, hedge fund manager. You know, he put in $29 million into this thing. So I think when you're talking about the environment, you can really bring along a lot of folks who might not otherwise support environmental causes if it's framed as efficiency. Businesses like efficiency. You know, conservatives like efficiency. It's not about drinking your cod liver oil and wearing a sweater and you know, when it's cold and things like that, or riding your bike in the rain for Mother Earth. It's about how do you not waste things. And if you're a business and you want to lower your electricity bills, it doesn't matter whether you believe in global warming. Efficiency is a good thing. And I think that's what happened here. And, you know, it also may well launch a political career for Tom Steyer, who I think you might see as a potential gubernatorial candidate on the Democratic side if Jerry Brown does not run again in 2014 or if he does in 2018.
That's Paul Rogers. He's the managing editor for KQED's science programs and the environmental writer for the San Jose Mercury News. You can find links to his work and to ours at kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. California voters may have paved the way to a cleaner future, but they're still famous for the gas-burning way they get around.
LA is a great big freeway. Put 100 down and buy a car.
Most of us drive plenty. Some of us are driving right now. And sometimes we drive the same route so much, it can seem like the car can find its own way, even if we're blindfolded.
Ben, that doesn't work.
Wait a minute. Chris?
Yep.
That's our sound engineer, Chris Hoff.
Yellow.
So you're saying it's a myth that we can actually drive blindfolded?
That is correct.
Well, Chris, anyone can put that to the test right now at the Tech Museum in San Jose. They've got an exhibit there from the TV show Mythbusters that includes one place where you can see whether or not you can drive blindfolded.
No, you can't.
All right, Chris says you can't. But it's an interesting enough question that many, many people have taken it on, including Roman Mars.
I'm Roman Mars.
That's the host and producer of the design series 99% Invisible, heard right here on KALW. And this is his story about a special kind of driving test.
If I asked you to close your eyes and mimic the action of using one of the simple human interfaces in everyday life, you could probably do it, no problem. Without having a button to push, you could close your eyes and pretend to push a button, and that action would accurately reflect the action of pushing a real button. Same with flipping a switch or turning a doorknob. If you close your eyes and fake the movement, it would sync up with its real-world use. Now, if I asked you to do the same thing with a car's steering wheel, you'd think you'd be able to describe steering accurately and mime the correct movements with your hands in the air. But you'd be wrong, so wrong. You'd probably kill a bunch of imaginary people. But don't just take my word for it.
Yeah, my name is Steve. I'm a human factors engineer.
His full name is Dr. Steve Clote. He just introduces himself as Steve. He's a casual guy.
And what was your research on? What's your main research that you've done?
And that's Tristan Cook, and Thomas Nelson is also in the room there asking questions of Steve. Tristan and Tom run this awesome blog called Humans in Design.
My interests are in driver behavior.
So here's the exercise. Put your hands up and grip an imaginary steering wheel. 10 and 2.
So I've got my hands at 10 and 2.
10 and 2.
Yep.
Now I want you to mime the action of changing lanes to the right. Have you tried it? All right, if you're like most people, and according to Steve's research, we're talking the vast majority of people, you turned your imaginary wheel 45 degrees to the right or so, and then back to the center. And that's the action for changing lanes. But that's not right.
What you've described is actually the sequence of movements that you require for turning a corner.
To actually change lanes, you have to turn the steering wheel to the right, then turn it back, crossing the center line, turning the wheel an equal amplitude to the left to correct your heading, and then back to the center. Knowing that this weird brain hiccup existed, Steve's team at the University of Queensland tested people in driving simulators. And sure enough, if you provided visual feedback, people could change lanes no problem. But as soon as you turned off the screen or blindfolded them and told them to change lanes, even though they had only just moments ago successfully performed the correct action, they couldn't do it.
They produced pretty catastrophic errors.
Given no other feedback, you can't change lanes using a steering wheel without vision. I mean, since cars are designed to be driven with your eyes open, that's okay. And in fact, this is a funky example. That doesn't mean that a steering wheel is a bad interface design. You could probably argue the opposite. You could argue that a steering wheel is so well designed that anyone can use it with just a little bit of feedback in the real world, even though they can't describe how they use it in the abstract.
So people didn't learn? They just did the same?
Over the course of an experiment, which takes about 45 minutes to an hour, the size of the error was pretty consistent.
But Steve and his researchers decided to test this in a real car. So Steve got something like $50 million worth of insurance and took people out in a real car and drove them down a test road and then took their vision away and asked them to change lanes. Our friends Tristan and Tom were two of the participants.
The first time you took vision away from me, it was absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like when Obi-Wan Kenobi was teaching Luke Skywalker how to use a lightsaber without using his eyes.
With the blast shield down, I can't even see.
In the first few runs, people made the same mistake they did in the simulator. Essentially, they were told to change lanes, and they moved the steering wheel in such a way that they turned a corner instead. But here's where things get really interesting.
Stretch out with your feelings.
People gradually started to improve, and by the end of the real-world blind trial, they were performing almost perfect lane changes.
See? You can do it.
I call it luck.
In my experience, there's no such thing as luck.
When you're driving a car, you have a whole bunch of extra visual information that you can use to supplement vision.
There's the vestibular system that senses your balance, or the somatosensory system that senses pressure on your skin as your thigh presses into the seat as you turn a corner.
One gives an erroneous signal. Yeah. The others would correct it.
Well, that's right.
Using all those extra senses, people learned how to perform the lane change in a real car, blindfolded. But here's the crazy part. After it was over, they asked the participants to mime a lane change with an imaginary steering wheel in their hands. And sure enough, they went right back to making the same mistake, performing a corner turn instead of a lane change.
Just at how robust this error was and how it was resistant to learning.
The steering wheel is pretty nicely mapped to our intuition, but it still requires the slightest bit of feedback so that our brain knows how to use it. But we still manage. Also, I can't stress this enough, people. Don't drive blindfolded. Really, you're not going to be able to do it. All right, I'm glad we had this chat.
That edition of 99% Invisible was produced by Roman Mars, along with Tristan Cook and Tom Nelson from the blog Humans in Design. Find them and friend them at our Facebook page. We're KALW News. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. Driving blindfolded might sound insane, but plenty of us do something that is practically the same all the time. We drive while talking, or texting, or even emailing, and it's only getting worse. We know it's unsafe. Studies show texting while driving makes you 23 times more likely to get in a wreck. But now that computer monitors are being built right into car dashboards, we're probably going to multitask more and more, which made us wonder, are we getting better at it? UCSF neuroscientist Adam Ghazali has an idea. He oversees the school's MRI machines and runs Ghazali Labs, which study ways to make the brain more efficient. I dropped by his office in San Francisco's Mission Bay to ask him how our brains are evolving in the information age.
It's not that multitasking is good or bad or better or worse than single tasking in general. It's that it has certain advantages and disadvantages, and you have to use our understanding about what those are to guide your decisions. I mean, it's sort of like that for everything in terms of nutrition, to sun exposure, to exercise, that, it's not an all or none, and you know, decisions could be made based on our understanding about it. So, for example, although there's not a lot of evidence on it, there's certainly the anecdotal evidence that multitasking is more fun. There's a novelty of switching between events that people describe. We are, in essence, novelty-seeking creatures. We have been. It's been an evolutionary drive of ours, and it's reasonable to propose that a given period of time of multitasking has more novelty than single tasking. And we also know on the flip side that multitasking leads to a decrement in performance, especially when something is really demanding of a high level of attention. So based on those two concepts about the pluses and minuses of multitasking, I tend to use it differently depending on what I'm doing. So for example, I will spend a good 3 hours of my day doing low-level things that are incredibly boring that I have no chance of getting done if I do one at a time and just multitask away. But when I know that I have to now turn to a paper or a grant that needs a high level of detail that might have a timestamp on it, I shut my email, close my door, put my phone in airplane mode, and do one thing for a couple hours.
That's Adam Ghazali. He is founding director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center at UCSF. So for me, I am constantly multitasking on my job with the different responsibilities I have in the news department. So I end up doing a lot of my conversations with people, longer conversations, while I'm commuting. And so if I'm driving or biking, both of which I do, then I'll have a hands-free device, which allows me to talk. That's not illegal, but it's not necessarily safe. What do you think about something like that?
Well, it goes back to the beginning of this discussion, is that just because your eyes are on the road doesn't mean your brain's on the road. And it's been documented that the impact of having a cell phone conversation while driving is not very different depending whether you're hands-free or not. So it's a little bit of a misconception to think that just because your hands are now free, you're driving at the same level that you would if you weren't having a conversation. And that's because your attention is being diverted. It could be diverted to a very, very large degree by a telephone conversation without your vision actually being physically disrupted at all. And that's an awareness that we should all have. And I think a lot of people intuitively have it. You might be on a very easy stretch of road and feel comfortable. But you know, when you're, it's gotten more complicated, something's going on, you might even hang up and ask to get off the phone. And so that's a very important realization that we should have, that just because it's not illegal, it's not dangerous. Another interesting aspect of the data, none of this was done by my lab, but by colleagues, is that when you're having a conversation with someone in the car, there is not that increased risk noted on your driving abilities, which is very interesting. I think the hypothesis for that is that when someone's actually in the car and participating in the safety of the driving experience, they modulate the conversation based upon what they're seeing along with you. While when you're having a conversation with someone that's not there, they're actually pulling your attention away independent of the events that are occurring. So this might be some of the reasons why a conversation with a passenger versus one on a cell phone might have differential impacts on your performance.
Do you think, therefore, perhaps legislators should consider the effect of having a phone call, say, the phone call itself, whether it's hands-free or not, on whether it's legal or not to conduct a conversation by phone while driving, say?
For sure. I mean, I think it should certainly be considered, especially since driving and car accidents are such a large cause of fatalities and injuries, that if something is well documented to cause an increased risk like this, and it's so frequently engaged in, then it should certainly be considered. Another interesting aspect to think about here is that not everyone is equally impaired by this type of activity, and so there might and maybe not everyone's equally impaired at any given time. There might be some days that, let's say, you had a bad night's sleep and are much more fatigued than another time, that anyone might be more susceptible to this. So I've often thought of a way of having a car detect your level of ability to engage,
a brainalyzer test.
Exactly. Maybe say, we're not even going to let you listen to the radio on this particular trip, or something of that level, to use quantitative data to determine how much multitasking is actually permitted during the driving experience.
Or perhaps there could be some sort of a driving test where one could see how much ability they have actually to effectively multitask in that way.
Yeah, for sure. And what I was suggesting is even going a step further, this might not be a number that's associated with a person, but even a person might have variable abilities on different days. So you can imagine getting into your car and having an evaluation on the spot that's essentially going to determine, you know, what you can engage in during that trip. That, you know, for a person, it might not be enough to say that you're always okay to do this. And, you know, it's something to think about, since safety is such an important concern. And we know that multitasking and distraction has, you know, a significant impact on driving.
That's Adam Ghazali. He is an associate professor in neurology and physiology and psychiatry at UCSF. Are there any other topics that you think that we should touch upon?
In my laboratory, we focus largely on the impact of distraction and multitasking on memory, both short-term memory and long-term memory, and we see its consequences. We see that even the act of having your eyes open decreases the quality of your memory. Even the act of being in a restaurant and having restaurant chatter also impacts your memory. So we see in our lab that our brains are exquisitively sensitive to even the distraction of normal environmental stimuli, even when you're not engaging in them as another task. So, you know, that's what we focus on in our lab, understanding the mechanisms in the brain that cause us to be so sensitive to interference, which is a global term that I use for both distraction, which is irrelevant information, and multitasking is when you try to do more than one thing at a time. What makes us so sensitive to this interference? How does it change across our lifespans? And then reaching beyond memory to perception and decision-making and other type of activities. So while our lab really focuses on the mechanisms in your brain that make you so sensitive to interference and its impact on cognition, there's a whole wider array. We've touched on a little about it: impact on safety, impact on development, impact on family and personal relationships, impact on the workplace. It does have such broad influence on our lives. And as we started this conversation, it seems that it's increasing. You know, that's still an open-ended question of why. And some of it, you know, just seems, you know, due to the amazing devices that we have that make it so accessible and so easy to multitask and sometimes hard not to. So, you know, it's a fun topic with lots of little branches in it.
Adam Ghazali is the founding director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center at UCSF. Do you find yourself multitasking more and more? What do you do to focus your mind? Share your ideas on our tip line, 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We'll share the most thought-provoking on the air. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. Today's team includes Isabel Angel, Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Laura Flynn, RTM's Konohovs, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Mu, Lisa Ratner, Eva Sansin, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Holly Kernan is our news director. The segment of 99% Invisible had support from Lunar, Making a Difference with Creativity, the American Institute of Architects in San Francisco, and the Center for Architecture and Design. Thanks to City CarShare, which provides an alternative transportation option to our reporters. City CarShare is online at citycarshare.org. And most importantly, thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. You're listening to the Bay Area group Musica Pacifica. They're performing 3 Christmas concerts this weekend in Palo Alto, Berkeley, and San Francisco. You can find all the details and locations at our website, kalw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Treffen.